All right, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to GTI's first public seminar of 2018. Thank you all for also braving the elements outside to participate in today's fantastic event. GTI is a 501c3 think tank dedicated to Taiwan policy research and enhancing the U.S.-Taiwan relationship by contributing towards a more informed public discussion about Taiwan here in the United States and around the world. In pursuit of our mission, we undertake several major programs. They include a Global Taiwan Brief, which is a biweekly journal providing information and analysis, as well as informed opinions related to Taiwan. Two, our public seminar series, where we invite leading scholars, academics, and practitioners to discuss timely developments related to Taiwan, such as the issue that we will be discussing here today. Three, our occasional report series, longer length reports. We have several lined up for 2018 already. They include reports about mutual legal assistance in the digital age, as well as Taiwan's indigenous defense industries. So stay tuned for those releases. Our annual symposiums, as well as our fellowship opportunities. If you're not already subscribed to receive our updates about our programs, you can visit our website at www.globaltaiwan.org for more information. Before I begin, I'd also like to acknowledge our board members, advisors, as well as our small staff, but capable staff, that make all our programs possible. So allow me to begin. The Indo-Asia-Pacific is not a term created by the Trump administration. The concept also did not begin with Secretary of State Tillerson's speech in October 2017, underscoring a free and open Indo-Pacific. In fact, it has deep roots in American strategic thinking towards the areas contiguous to the Indian and Pacific Oceans. The commander of U.S. Pacific Command, U.S. Admiral Harry Harris, highlighted the importance of the Indo-Asia-Pacific in his testimony before the Senate Armed Services Committee in April 2017. In which he stated, quote, "The U.S. has enduring national interests in the Indo-Asia-Pacific. America's future security and economic prosperity are indelibly linked to the critical region, which is now at a strategic crossroads where real opportunities meet real challenges," unquote. Admiral Harris went on to highlight the need for maintaining what he called the global operating system, or as we will often refer it to here in Washington, a rules-based international order, as necessary for peace and stability and for furthering economic prosperity for the entire region. Perhaps most importantly, in making this critical point, the Admiral highlighted how security underpins that rules-based order. Now, there are four critical principles for this global operating system. According to Admiral Harris, quote, "There are the rule of law, adherence to standards, peaceful resolution of disputes, freedom of navigation for all civilian and military vessels and aircraft, and open access to the sea, air, space, and cyber domains. Its outcomes are twofold: enhanced security and unimpeded lawful commerce," unquote. It's also worth noting that the former Assistant Secretary of State under the Obama administration, Kirk Campbell, also made a similar case in his 2016 book, The Pivot. Against the backdrop of uncertainty among U.S. allies and partners over the value placed by the Trump administration on the alliances, Secretary Tillerson's October speech emphasizing the essential role of three democracies, Australia, Japan, and India, in a free and open Indo-Pacific, and was cheered on by allies and partners throughout the region. President Trump expanded this vision in his whirlwind trip throughout Asia in November, which he spoke about an Indo-Pacific dream, which appears to be a play on Chinese President Xi Jinping's China dream. The Trump administration then reinforced this vision for Indo-Pacific by releasing its long-awaited national security strategy in December. In the first explicit reference to Taiwan in the Trump administration, Trump administration's nascent grand strategy, the NSS stated that the U.S. intent to, quote, "maintain our strong ties with Taiwan in accordance with our One China policy, including our commitments under the Taiwan Relations Act to provide for Taiwan's legitimate defense needs and deter coercion." The current Assistant Secretary of Defense for Asian and Pacific Security Affairs, Randy Shriver, stated at a conference in late November organized by the Project 2049 Institute, which he headed before going back into government, that the President's vision for a free and open Indo-Pacific, quote, "suggests that there should be a key role for Taiwan," unquote. Indeed, in the 2017 NSS, Taiwan was discussed in the military and security paragraph of the section on priority actions in the region. And mention of Taiwan, the preceding text that mentions Taiwan explains the U.S. approach to the entire region as, quote, we will maintain a forward military presence capable of deterring and, if necessary, defeating any adversary. We will strengthen our long-standing military relationships and encourage the development of a strong defense network with our allies and partners. While these may be considered to be clear signals, there are still much to unpack from this emerging grand strategy. And to help us better understand the strategy itself and Taiwan's potential role in it, we're very pleased to have four very top experts. You have your biographies, I believe, so I will not go through their long list of accomplishments. But to my immediate left, we have Miles Yu. He is a professor of East Asia Military and Naval History at the United States Naval Academy. To his left, we have Patrick Cronin, who is a senior advisor and senior director of the Asia-Pacific Security Program at the Center for New American Security. To his left, Bonnie Glazer, who is a senior advisor for Asia and director of the China Power Project at CSIS. And last but not least, we have Zach Cooper, who is a senior fellow for Asian Security at CSIS. In keeping with the format of our public seminar series, I prepared a series of questions for our experts to discuss. And we'd like to reserve about 15 minutes at the end of the seminar for audience Q&A. So allow me to begin. Miles, I'd like to start with you. As a naval historian, you are a leading authority to explain the origins and the concept of a geographic Indo-Pacific or Indo-Asia-Pacific in U.S. lexicon. What does it refer to, and what are the origins of this concept in U.S. geopolitical thinking? I would just like to add one point, that the comments that our speakers make are their own and do not represent necessarily the organizations that they are affiliated with.
Very good. Thank you, Russell, for inviting me, and I'm delighted to be here. I feel like I'm in free China again. So, since you label me a leading authority on Indo-Pacific, so I live up to that reputation. I spent 2 days to make myself an expert on that. Now, the concept of Indo-Pacific is one of the many monikers that really do not mean much unless you have something substantive over here. Asia-Pacific, Pacific Rim, for example, that was very fashionable in 20-some years ago. Now you don't hear about Pacific Rim anymore. But for a naval historian, the concept of Indo-Pacific was nothing new. It's been there for hundreds of years. If you're thinking about the Spanish rise as a colonial power in the 16th century, 1500s, once they acquire the Philippines in 1550s, I mean, that's Indo-Pacific. Right? They go all over the place over there. For the British Royal Navy, for example, I mean, if you look at their choke points, they got Gibraltar, they got the Suez Canal, and then they got Singapore, right? And the Strait of Malacca. So those were all wrapped up in this global vision that oceans are sort of all connected. I think Indo-Pacific in contemporary parlance did not come into fashion after probably 2007. There's an Indian scholar, I think based in England, published an article. He first used this phrase Indo-Pacific, but it was not the way that we talk about it. It's from the Indian scholar's point of view, because India was there, so it has to say something about India. Now, the first time I heard about this, I think Patrick also used that phrase very early on, but the first time I heard about this was in 2010. I invited a scholar from American Enterprise Institute, Misha Osley, to Annapolis to give a talk. And I just went back to check on my record. In 2010, his title was Competition Among Indian Pacific Nations, Indo-Pacific Nations. So that's caught my attention over there. I think the currency of this phrase has much to do with two very important factors. One is that, another thing that's really, really important, for the U.S. Navy, for example, Indian Ocean and Pacific Ocean are always connected in our strategic thinking. PACOM, for example, is an AOR, Area of Responsibilities, contain both Indian Ocean and Pacific. So there is no dispute about that. And only in the Paycom was created in, after World War II, so in the late 1940s. And only in the 1980s, one small portion of that Paycom AOR was reassigned to CENTCOM. That's the Gulf of Aden in that area. But for the longest time, Indo-Pacific is always the in the Navy's mind. And we always plan that way. The reason why we don't talk about the India is, has many historical unfortunate happenings. One of the most important things is that is our fascination with things going on in Western Pacific. It is not happening in China, in Japan. We have a lot of press coverage. We pay a lot of attention to it. A lot of things happening in India, you don't see much of a press coverage. So that's basically the historical sort of a lack of indolence, shall we say. And then, of course, the currency of this Indo-Pacific phrase it has something to do with two factors. One is China. China placed premium on its naval expansion. Somewhere, they pay attention to what's going on in the Pacific, but they focus a lot in the last 10, 15 years or so on their presence in the Indian Ocean. And by way of, for example, anti-piracy missions and also their cozy relationship with Pakistan, and they want to basically control the entrance to the Persian Gulf, so they develop like a water port, all the things. And you might argue water port may have dual use, but the fact that China was there, that's pretty important. So it becomes China's presence in the Indian Ocean that really sort of grab our attention, so we normally lump Pacific and India together, Indian Ocean together. Another reason was really the rise of India. India, under Vijay Singh, and particularly under Modi, I mean, economy is on fire, right? India has become a very important region in many, many ways. It has been always important, but now, particularly with our disappointment with Pakistan as an ally since 21, and then our strategic tilt toward India has been intensified. And that tilt actually is started in 1990s. We have to give much credit to Hillary Clinton. I mean, she was really fascinated with India, visited there many times. And then afterwards, since after 9/11, and because our alliance with Pakistan sort of dissipated, and the harbor of Osama bin Laden and that basically make the relationship sour. So we place important in India. And with the Chinese-Indian border dispute becoming really hot, and the strategic value of India, and it become very, very important. And to be frankly, India is always very difficult to deal with as an ally, because they can be very cranky. So under Modi, and it become far less cranky, and it's becoming really, really cooperative. And for one reason, why is it alone? That's because China. And that really is very important because of the role of Japan. Now, Japan and India become very cozy for many reasons. And one of the most important reasons was the common threat of China. So they become very, very close. And there's also a deep, profound historical background to this. That is, Shinzo Abe came out as a conservative. He has a very long-standing ties with the old Japan before World War II, right? His family is all related to that. Now, if you recall, Shinzo Abe, before he became prime minister, he loved Indians because India, during the Tokyo criminal trial after World War II, the only judge on that panel that was in favor of Japan, he acquitted every Japanese criminal, was an Indian judge, right? So when Japan nowadays was so fed up with South Korea, China constantly bring the history back to the current international relationship, Shinzo Abe said, well, the heck with you, I'm going to India. So there was a lot of good feeling built upon that. I mean, memory of World War II played a very important role in Japanese politics, particularly India and Burma. So that's where I'm going to stop.
Great. Well, I'd like to stick with you, though, Miles, still. making you work for coming all the way down from Annapolis, even though you're the farthest person that coming from the farthest area. So a multilateral alliance system in Asia, as suggested by the Indo-Pacific strategy, is unprecedented, not because it has not been considered in the past, but rather it had been opposed by senior U.S. policymakers in preference or a system based on bilateral alliances. Now, you touched on this a bit when you, in the ending of your first response, but why were past efforts unsuccessful? And I'm thinking immediately post-World War II. And based on a recent article you wrote for the Hoover Institute, you seem to think that it can be succeed now. Why?
Well, there was a reason why the peculiar, I use the word very, very intentionally, peculiar alliance system in Asia, because our alliance system, the most important one, was the North Atlantic Treaty, or NATO. And that was a multilateral. And the terms of that is very, very clear. It was very much like the 1871 Germany-Austria-Hungary alliance. That is a mutual alliance treaty. That is, if one party of the treaty was attacked by the third country, the treaty parties will come there in the mutual defense through use of arms. NATO was that very clear. Now, when it comes to Asia after World War II, there were three considerations which I think were all valid. We did not adopt the multilateral approach. We adopted bilateral. In other words, U.S. signed treaty with individual country, with Japan, with the Philippines, with South Korea. There's a reason for that. The reasons were very valid at the time. Number one, the three reasons. One is there were no common enemies. I mean, Taiwan, South Korea may say, you know, communism is the enemy, but people in Southeast Asia, those countries, they may think of British and France, and they might be the enemy. So there's very hard to put them together. In Europe, the common enemy was the Soviet Union, and they would agree to that, so they put them together. So number two, there was no sort of a common values, democratic values. There are many countries in Asia who could be considered an ally, but they're ally of convenience. They're not democratic. They're different. Like Taiwan, for example, like South Korea, like the Philippines. So you have to really sign country one at the time. The third reason, which I think is very, very important, that is the U.S. signed alliance not just for self-defense, they also try to prevent provocations. If you sign the mutual alliance, multilateral treaties, if one of the countries is bent on attack, say, mainland China, and then everybody's dragged into the whole thing. And U.S. policymakers will very worry about this. Even if you look at 1954, U.S.-Taiwan Mutual Alliance Treaty, Kimo and Mao were excluded. Because that's a hotspot. So this was an insistence of John Foster Dulles. So I think those three reasons exist in 1950s, but now they're gone. Number one, there was a common threat in Asia, China. China has 14 land borders, land neighbors, have a half a dozen maritime neighbors. China, at some point in some time in history, has a border or maritime dispute with all of them. So that's one reason why I was mentioning earlier, if Japan and India get together, their coalition is a coalescing effort is forming there. It's hard for me to imagine when China attacks one country, other countries will not respond. Okay, now it's not easy to form that kind of, you know, alliance, but situation has changed. Secondly, since mid-1980s, the democratization in Asia has taken root, starting from the Philippines. Many of the U.S. allies we have bilateral treaties with were no longer dictatorship or authoritarian regimes, Taiwan, South Korea, for example, right? So you have a large enough countries who share the common values. The Australians just propose a Quad, right? They say, you know, Australia, Japan, India, and the U.S. form a quadrilateral alliance. But that's the beginning. The third reason is that no country in Asia Pacific or Indo Pacific is contemplating to retake China, to come to attack China first. So the risk of preventing accidental or gung-ho spirit to provoke the war, general, that would drag the entire alliance into a general role with China, is almost non-existent. So based upon those three reasons, I think it's time for us to change our alliance approach to form and try a multilateral, values-based alliance in Asia-Pacific.
Thanks very much for that, Miles. Move to you, Patrick. Fast forward now, the infrastructure for this free and open Indo-Pacific will be centered on the United States, Japan, Australia, and India, a grouping that's also known as the Quad. This isn't the first time that the Quad has been sort of tried. why has previous attempts failed, and explain whether you think it will be successful this time around, and why.
Well, Russell, thank you. It's great to be here, and I apologize for walking in late. I think the first point is that the national security strategy out of the administration's reference to the free and open Indo-Pacific strategy and to the Quad, it's a statement about power. It's a statement about the balance of power and the need to preserve a favorable balance of power. It's respect for other major powers, even if they're following a revisionist agenda like Russia and China, even middle powers that are looking to have nuclear arms. It's about the power that they're trying to acquire, and non-state actors as well, trying to upset power and order. So this document is reflecting enduring U.S. interests and respect for long-term interests in power, not some short-term sort of prescription that was just drafted up last week for next year. This is really a long-term. So when we say, you know, we'll be successful this time around, think about managing North Korea. If you think about the North Korean nuclear policy for the United States, you could argue that the last 25 years has been a failure, right? If you want to say a failure to stop the growth of nuclear weapons from accumulating in terms of capability on North Korea. All administrations have failed to stop that. It's been a failure. If you take a longer view, say 65 years since the armistice, 1953, I would say it's an unmitigated success. Our Korea policy is an unmitigated success because we have a democracy, 11th largest economy in the world as an ally. We are strong and prosperous together, and we've deterred major war from breaking out. It's a success. So, you know, you have to take a long-term view here. And I think on the quadrilateral mechanism, it's not so much the infrastructure of this strategy. It is pointing, though, to some of the means of implementing an effective long-term strategy, right? So this is not institution building yet. This is really about trying to bring pool big powers, big democratic powers together, caucus a bit about the direction of strategy, think through priorities, think through synergies, what could be, how could we leverage our limited power together in successful ways to build a kind of inclusive, long-term, democratic, prosperous region that's now really joined by technology and as well as historically by the seas and now even on land. And this Indo-Pacific area has to be the most dynamic set of regions in the world. So it's really important to think through how do we leverage our limited power together with these other democracies. So if we think throughout the 21st century, we can go back to 1945, the end of World War II, and think about the close relationship the United States had with the United Kingdom, France, and Germany. I'd say those are four important powers who will help to forget before NATO came along. Just think about the values, think about the interests, think about how to steer the security and prosperity of the transatlantic region and even have a global impact for the following decades to come. So I think of it more along those lines. There's no perfect historical analogy, so don't press me on saying, well, this is different. I know it's different. I'm just trying to say that if you take a long-term view and you think about major powers that are like-minded, these four naturally come together in the Indo-Pacific region to deal with this. So I think the scope of what they can do, we can talk about. But they are mostly going to work bilaterally. They're mostly going to work maybe trilaterally from time to time. Only occasionally will they work quadrilaterally. And it may not be just quadrilateral. It may be with five or six or eight countries, but with the four included. So it's not mostly a quadrilateral institution. But if you think about what just happened this week with Prime Minister Abe and Prime Minister Turnbull, they're ready to sign, essentially, Zach can correct me on this if I'm premature, but I mean a visiting forces agreement, which is basically as close as you can get to a military alliance without being an alliance almost. I mean, it's very close. It's getting to be very close in terms of military cooperation. And I think, the United States is already allied with Australia and Japan. So those three countries are going to continue to work very closely militarily. India is obviously the odd man out from this group. It's not a treaty ally. It's a strong non-aligned country. It's a strong, proud major power. It's going to remain that way. But its interests are driving it to closer and closer cooperation with the United States, with Japan, with Australia. And it wants a good relationship with China, but it knows it's going to be competing with China. So it's, as with all of these countries, we're going to get more leverage by pooling our ideas together, our strategies, and where it's appropriate to cooperate, whether it's on economic issues or whether it's on security issues, whether it's on political agendas, whether it's on civil society and democracy issues. I think there is a lot of scope there for cooperation. So I think it can be successful if we take the long-term view. If we take a short-term view, you will say this is a failure. There's no way we can put into this relationship content that matters that much in the next 3 years that will make that much of a difference. But if you look at the next 30, 50 years, I think this is going to be an extraordinarily significant caucus within this vast Indo-Pacific region on which U.S. interests so much depend, on which Taiwan's future, I think, so much depends as a vibrant democracy in Asia.
If I may, I'd like to stay with you here. And you mentioned this briefly also as well, but a key element of this Indo-Pacific strategy is that we can assess in terms of where it might go is the national security strategy that the Trump administration had released last month in December. And so for many of us outside the government to try to assess where it fits within the overall sort of strategic, you know, approach, can you give us a sense in terms of what the NSS tell us about the vision for a free and open Indo-Pacific? You mentioned that it focuses on, you know, power competition, but where are we headed, perhaps, and what does it tell us in terms of where we're headed?
Well, again, you can read this document through different lenses, and many of my friends have done so. And if you want to say this is mostly a document about continuity in U.S. policy with a few sharp edges, I think that's a fair reading. But if you want to pick up what's different about it, I mean, clearly, calling out the strategic competition with China is a bold declaratory policy for the United States. In recent decades, that has not been the tenor that's been taken by any administration. So it's the frankest national security strategy we've had since Reagan's first one, in my view. You know, how successful that will be in calling that out depends on how well they are able to implement their objectives here. And that's where, now that the strategy's out in year one, it's very important to try to mobilize your allies and partners together around this common agenda of this free and open Indo-Pacific, and to protect our interests and to protect essentially the rules-based system that we've been trying to work with, but which the strategy says is going in an unfavorable trend now. It's going in the wrong direction, essentially, and we need to do something different. We need to be more disruptive, and we need to try to figure out something to do that will change that. I'm all for disruption, provided it has a strategic effect that you desire. If it's disruption for disruption's sake, well, now you're just diverting attention. So, you know, there's a fine line here. We have to, as a government, you know, and we'll all be living with the consequences of this. So, you know, we all are on the same boat in some ways. It must find a way to successfully convert this bold statement about America first as working with free and open sort of broader center of gravity in this Indo-Pacific Asia region, working with allies and partners, respecting power, building up prosperity, but building up strength at the same time, but expecting our allies and partners to shoulder greater burdens, since the United States has recognized the diffusion of power to the rest of the world. So it's very important to put this together. And the quadrilateral mechanism is one of the means by which, again, you can kind of have a steering group to think through some of the ideas for how this goes forward. Anyway, I think the national security strategy on the Indo-Pacific is interesting because you'll notice that it starts off with focusing on the Indo-Pacific, and Asia-Pacific and Indo-Pacific are in this document in the center of gravity. They still have South Asia, though, so they're not sure exactly how Indo-Pacific and South Asia overlap. So as you read the document, the South Asia is really, it's Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, sort of there, isn't it? Yeah. And so it's not sure. So from my take, the Indo and Indo-Pacific strategy is actually a long-term interest. The Obama administration wanted to put Indo-Pacific strategy together. They couldn't do it bureaucratically. They were able to do it rhetorically, as when Secretary Clinton was able to talk about India and the Pacific Oceans need to be, you know, tied closely together. George W. Bush administration wanted to do everything possible to bring India into that strategy. But again, they were in early days of sort of thinking through this warming relationship with India. So I think Here, the Trump administration has just bitten the bullet and said, we're going to call it, you know, the Free and Open Indo-Pacific. We understand it doesn't have the word Asia in it, but we'll explain that that's really just representing that India is now has to be part of this broader Indo-Asia-Pacific region. And it's going to be a growing partner with the United States, even if it's not going to be a formal ally. And it's going to be a growing partner with Japan and Australia. And it sort of it speaks to this larger sort of aperture through which we're going to look in time window. We're going to look through at this region. We're going to take a long view, a strategic look on power. And we're going to preserve this. And this is how it's going to be done over the decades to come. So I think that's how to look at it.
That's great, Patrick.
Bonnie, I'd like to shift to you over here now. As the sort of resident China expert, you know, on our panel here, I'd like to, a point that's not explicitly stated but clearly implied in this new and free and open Indo-Pacifics is China as a focal point. At a Hudson event 2 weeks ago, Ashley Tullis stated that the U.S. conceptualization of Indo-Pacific as a geopolitical region is driven in part by Beijing's actions. Are conjoining the Indian and Pacific Oceans. Why do you think the Trump administration has chosen China as its main focal point, and how has China reacted to this strategy?
Well, it's interesting that you say that the Free and Open Indo-Pacific has China as its focal point. I suppose if you add up what has been said by U.S. officials and what's in the national security strategy, you certainly will see there's a lot of discussion of China, and there's discussion of China outside of the near page and a half on the Indo-Pacific strategy that's in the national security strategy. But at the same time, it actually says the U.S. vision for the Indo-Pacific excludes no nation. So I think, yes, the Indo-Pacific strategy is being formulated in a way that is intended to cope with some of the challenges that this administration sees coming from China. But at the same time, it doesn't want to say that it's aimed at China, it's a containment strategy. And indeed, you know, if you ask U.S. Officials, they will say this is not about containing China. There is a difference, I think, an important distinction. Of course, there are many aspects of this strategy that are about China, but I think what the administration is trying to do is to put forward a positive vision of what we want the Indo-Pacific to be. And that has to do with cooperating with partners that we share some basic positions and interests with. I think there's discussions within the administration about how much do we talk about democracy, for example. We have partners in the region who aren't very democratic. We don't want to exclude them. We want them to work with us. And Vietnam would be an example of a country on that list. So, you know, do we talk about human rights and things like that as part of our free and open Indo-Pacific strategy? And I think people are still discussing that. Well, there's a lot of interesting language which Patrick cited about China. There's concern about Chinese challenges to the rules-based order, Chinese coercion against smaller neighbors. There's concern that's articulated about China threatening other nations' sovereignty. We heard this first really in Secretary Tillerson's speech at CSIS, which is really the first place that this free and open Indo-Pacific was launched. And so I see the strategy itself is trying to bring together nations who share these concerns. And there's many of them. Obviously, there are, you know, Taiwan has been the target of Chinese, for example, political influence operations for a long time, economic coercion. We have a lot, the growing list of countries that are targeted by China's economic pressure is certainly growing. So there's a lot that the administration, I think, is trying to pull together in terms of concerns about China. I would say that the approach any administration has when they come into power is how are you going to deal with the challenges that China poses. When the Obama administration came in, the first thing they tried to do was to engage in more partnership with China to address global challenges. And this is what could be referred to as the inside-out approach. And then later on, when they switched more to the Asia-Pacific pivot, that was more what we might call an outside-in approach. So the Indo-Pacific strategy is very much an outside-in approach. That means you work with other like-minded countries who have shared concerns about China, and you try to use that cooperation and collaboration to try and influence China's choices. So that's the way that I would describe it. Very briefly, I think you asked, how has China reacted to this strategy? Well, China didn't like the Asia-Pacific pivot. It certainly doesn't like the Indo-Pacific or free and open Pacific strategy. China would prefer if the United States were distracted, maybe paying attention to the Middle East. They were very happy that we were bogged down in the Middle East for a decade. Or if we were more isolationist and paying attention to our problems at home, they'd like that too. So, of course, the Chinese don't want to see anything that would be an anti-China coalition or states that are working together who share certain interests that maybe are not to China's benefit. So there's no doubt China doesn't like that. Their official comments have been very brief so far. The Chinese Foreign Ministry, for example, criticized the national security strategy in general. It urged the U.S. to stop deliberately distorting China's strategic intentions and abandon its Cold War mentality. We love that word. We hear it all the time. It just means they want us to get rid of our alliances, but you know, it means that we should do more to strengthen them. And it insisted that China will remain committed to world peace, global development, and the international order. But that said, the Chinese, I think, have a lot of confidence, increasingly so, in their position in the region. Their Belt and Road Initiative would be one example of that. And so I think that they, although they certainly are concerned about the Quad, free and open Indo-Pacific, at the end of the day, I think they see that the balance of power in the region is shifting in their favor.
Zach, I don't want you to think that I've forgotten about you. Okay, so I'm going to move to you quickly and then move back to Bonnie. But we've talked about Australia. We talked about India. Both Miles and Patrick have really helped to highlight the importance of these two democratic allies for the United States and this strategy. The other anchor, of course, is Japan. President Trump has said before that he and Prime Minister Abe share many similar views and are on the same page on a lot of issues. What is the Japanese vision for Indo-Pacific, for the Indo-Pacific region, and how does the U.S.-Japan alliance factor into it?
Well, first, Russell, I want to thank you and the team here for having me. I think this is an important topic, and I want to build on what Bonnie said right at the end, which was these changing power differentials. I think that's really where the Japanese start out on this Indo-Pacific concept. You know, from a decades-long geopolitical look, the real challenge for Japan is that it is a declining power, and its population is declining, its economy is declining pretty quickly relative to China, and the question is, how do you stabilize a situation where not only is Japan declining relative to China, but so is the United States? And I think the answer is you look abroad for a state that has similar interests to you that is rising, and the obvious answer there is India. And so I would say from a Japanese perspective, the Indo-Pacific strategy is really about bringing India into the region to help balance the region, not today or tomorrow, but over the very long term, and hoping that India's size relative to other countries is going to grow and that its interests are going to converge with those in the region. And so what you hear from the Japanese especially is that over the last few years, the foreign ministry has been talking about this free and open Indo-Pacific long before the United States ever started using the term. And their focus is really on India, a little bit on Australia. But I think India is the real win for them. I would say I think the White House adopted the term without fully appreciating all of the nuances, perhaps, of how the Japanese have used it, right? And you know, when you hear the term free and open Indo-Pacific, for me it's not apparent exactly what that means, right? But when you think about a strategy, I think sometimes it's most useful to think about the opposite of the strategy and what the administration is trying to push back against. So think about the Obama administration, the rebalance to Asia. Well, it was pushing back against the idea that there had been a rebalance from Asia under the Bush administration, right? It was very clear. You know, the America First strategy is pushing back against the idea that America has been second for a long time to other countries. Well, I think the free and open Indo-Pacific, if you think about the opposite, it's a closed and authoritarian a continental Asia, right? And it's pretty obvious what you're talking about when you talk about a closed and authoritarian continental Asia. It's China. And, you know, the other panelists have mentioned this, but I think the clear driver, not just for Japan, but also for the United States, is how to manage the rise of China. And the other panelists have mentioned the core concepts behind it, but I would say one of the real challenges for the administration in both Japan and in the United States is to put forward a positive vision to match what China is doing right now. You know, the Belt and Road approach is really quite influential in a lot of the region, and I would say the biggest problem for the administration is that having walked away from TPP, it doesn't have this very approachable economic plan that the Obama administration had been pursuing. And the idea that you're going to get bilateral trade deals for most of us is pretty hard to imagine now. So the administration has this free and open Indo-Pacific concept. I think many of us think in general that it's a good idea, but putting the meat on the bones is going to be a really tough challenge for them.
The previous speakers have also alluded to this, but Zach, just sticking with you here for one more question, is that the Indo-Pacific does seem to be very much a maritime sort of theater, a maritime concept. You recently co-authored an excellent report at CSIS focused on the sort of new and emerging trend in gray zone operations. The NSS also highlights U.S. concern about such operations. What do you think is the relevance of such operations in a free and open Indo-Pacific, and how should the U.S. and our partners and allies actually deal with it?
Well, thanks. I would say, you know, everyone has talked for a couple of years now about gray zone situations, right? These are situations between peace and war, and really the reason they've drawn attention is because people believe that the rules-based order is changing, and the question is, where is it changing? And the answer is, well, it's not the big parts of the order that are changing, right? You know, the WTO still exists, the United Nations still exists, so it's not the institutions necessarily, but it's the way the rules are interpreted is changing, or the agreement on the rules is being weakened, right? And so I think when you ask where is the order being weakened, the first place to look for many people has been the South China Sea, and certainly the Chinese activity in the South China Sea has been what I would call maritime coercion in gray zones, where we've seen China trying to avoid crossing a threshold, which would spur the United States or potentially a claimant to raise a conflict to the level that it would actually be called war, right? So instead, those claimants and the United States haven't responded in that way, and we see these gray zone operations. I think the challenge for the administration here in Washington is, thus far in the last year, we've heard a lot of talk from them about how tough they're going to be on maritime issues. But actually, they really haven't done that much on South China Sea issues. What they've done is increase the pace of freedom of navigation operations, which I think is a good thing. They've done them more quietly, which I also think is a good thing. But we haven't seen a full South China Sea strategy from them, which I think many people would have expected. You know, this is an administration which a year ago promised that it was going to roll back Chinese claims in the South China Sea, which I don't think most of us believed was likely to happen, but this is the objective that they set forth. So I think the real challenge for them is to think through which parts of the rules-based order do we want to uphold, and how much are we going to risk to uphold them. And this, for me, is also the challenge more broadly with the free and open Indo-Pacific. It's so broad, right? Everyone likes freedom. Most people like openness. So the question is, what parts are you willing to fight for and how much are you going to risk for them? And that, I think, is a question that we just don't know the answer yet from the administration. Part of it is that they haven't had senior officials confirmed for almost the whole time, right? You know, we just have Randy Shriver now. Susan Thornton is nominated but not in place. And so perhaps once these folks are all the way through the system, then we'll see some more clear-cut policies. But I think one of the real challenges for them is that they're still trying to figure out just how much, how firmly to push back against these moves to change the order and which moves to push back against.
make a really interesting
observation, Zach, and that is the this strategy for a free and open Indo-Pacific is very broad. And while I think it may be, you know, one could criticize it for not sort of lacking specifics in how to implement, it could also be considered sort of more as an asset that allows, you know, sort of partners and allies to be able to also partake in shaping this strategy that will actually be more cooperative than in sort of sharing of the burden, so to speak, on their part. And so, but Bonnie, I'd like to move to you and this before we go to sort of more of the communal questions that I have for the entire group. Is that, and you mentioned the Belt and Road Initiative, and I think that's very interesting because it's, you know, in some ways, this is sort of China's grand strategy. And the Tsai administration has also launched a revamped sort of southbound policy in 2016. You are also about to launch an in-depth report on the new southbound policy, I believe, this Friday. In what ways do you see the NSP, the new southbound policy, fitting into this free and open Indo-Pacific?
Thanks for the plug for my report. I hope you'll all come to our event, and I can't give away all of our findings. But we will talk about policy recommendations. We will have Minister John Deng giving a speech via DTC. And then we'll have a great panel, including a leading expert from Taiwan, to talk about it. And I really want to commend all the great work that GTI has done on the new southbound policy, too, and you, in particular, Russell, to try and explain it. Because obviously, as you say, this is sort of the third or maybe even fourth iteration. I don't think of this policy as a counter to the Belt and Road Initiative. And... if we couch our Indo-Pacific strategy as a counter to the Belt and Road Initiative, I think that would be a mistake, and I think it would be even a bigger mistake if Taiwan were to portray its new southbound policy as a counter to Belt and Road. Surely Taiwan doesn't have the kind of resources, for example, that China has put into the Belt and Road Initiative. But what I think President Tsai is trying to do with the Belt and Road, new southbound policy, is consistent with some of the things that I think the United States wants to do in the with its free and open Indo-Pacific strategy. Connectivity is a part of it, certainly. It's about developing relationships and more interdependence, innovation in Taiwan by drawing from expertise from other countries as well as immigrants that have come to Taiwan. So there are various components that are being developed. And I see it essentially as aimed at trying to make Taiwan more and more active part of the region, not just economically but also politically, to try and integrate Taiwan more into the region. And it's quite clear that China's strategy has been to isolate Taiwan. So it's a way of sort of staying below the radar, identifying ways to work together with other countries in a way that really highlights the great things that Taiwan can bring to the table and not provoke, I think, a strong reaction from China. So at the end of the day, it's really aimed at making Taiwan more secure and more prosperous. And I think that's something that very much serves the interests of the United States. And it makes Taiwan more a part of the region and develops relationships more in the region. And that's very much in interest of the United States. In fact, I would say our global cooperation training framework in many ways tries to bring the U.S. and Taiwan together with representatives of countries from the region. So I would say there's consistencies and there's overlap, but I definitely would not portray it as something that is seeking to counter the Belt and Road Initiative. And it is very much a strategy for Taiwan. And so I'm not sure I would say it needs to be part of our free and open Indo-Pacific strategy. But I know we're going to segue into a discussion of what Taiwan's role in that should be. And I'll let you go there because I think everybody's really interested in hearing that.
Thank you. Thank you, Bonnie. And then as the think tank focused on Taiwan, we couldn't have it, you know, a seminar and not talk about Taiwan. So these are the next few questions are communal for all the speakers. And so really I'd like to, after sort of laying out the backdrop of the free and open Indo-Pacific, the NSS, and the role of different allies and partners, I'd like to ask the panelists, what do you see as Taiwan's role, functional and political, in this free and open Indo-Pacific strategy? Building off of what, you know, Bonnie had already said, perhaps Miles, I'd like to start with you. Maybe you'd like to start.
Okay, yeah, so you. I was going to comment on some of the points earlier, but now Taiwan's it's a good segue into that. You know, the Trump administration started with economic nationalism. That is, focus on revitalizing the American economy, and that's why Russia was not important, because Russia's economy was 1/12 of the size of the United States economy. So China's number two is very, very close to our size. So that's why sort of the center of Trump's policy is economic and trade. So that's China, right? So Russia was never a big deal in his original vision. That's what probably one of the reasons why he got in trouble with the establishment. I would say on the defense related to that, his major pet peeve is that the Americans' overseas defense cost was not shared by allies. We paid too much, right? So that's his primary concern, I mean, throughout the campaign and also after he entered the White House. So what I would say is, if you want to get Trump's attention, you buy American weapons, and he will basically give you more focus. Which goes to India and Taiwan, because India is the world's number one arms importer. We sold India weapons that's just we never sold to anybody. For example, our PA, the top-notch naval surveillance anti-submarine plane. India is the only foreign country that operated the PA. We sold them 8 of them. Right. We're still selling them the heavy lifting transport planes, the C-3 series. So India, and that also has strategic implications, because India has been heavily relied upon Russian weapons. So they're trying to reduce that amount and buy more Americans. So this is a very good, it's a win-win. So Taiwan, obviously, you know, the weapon sales is very important. So I would say, you know, to beef up Taiwan's defense, this is also very important. Now, back to my earlier comments about the values-based multilateral alliance. China always like to divide and conquer, so they don't want any collective multilateral alliance. Look at the way they approach to ASEAN. They're steadfastly refusing to talk to ASEAN as a whole. They want to talk individually. So that's our weakness. So if we have a multilateral alliance, and that will basically, you know, get China's attention. Patrick made a very good point about what about those countries who are less democratic, share less value. And we have the same problem with NATO, right? When NATO was founded in 1949, we have Portugal, Spain, Turkey. Basically, they were pretty autocratic at the time. So, but that's how you influence them. You impact the policy. I know Franco didn't die until 1970s, you know, as Chevy Chase reminds us all the time. But no, Spain probably would not become a democratic if we were not part of the NATO nation for decades, right? So sooner, I'm saying it's going to happen. So this is the way you created this sort of honor system, and people want to join, and then they have a reform, right? And we talk about Taiwan. I mean, think about it. If Taiwan didn't have this diplomatic pressure, external pressure in the late 1970s, Taiwan probably would be less likely to become a vibrant democracy, at least from a timetable point of view, right? So international pressure is very important. So I would say Taiwan has done a remarkable job in that threat. Taiwan's dilemma, I think, is two. One is there are two fundamental transitions that take place in the last several decades in Taiwan. One did a very good job. That is a transition from the authoritarian regime to a democratic regime. Taiwan has done an incredible job. And this is the pride of Chinese, right? So this is really dynamic and a little chaotic, but that's democracy, right? So the transition, I was the election observer in 2000, and it was amazing for me to see that the power transition, the most important thing is the military, right? The Taiwanese army basically was the KMT dominated the military. It transitioned very peacefully, nicely to the opposition party. That was remarkable. Right? So that's a historic transition in Taiwan, played a very important role. If you want to get Taiwan into this ally, US-led alliance, that's the number one qualification. Taiwan is way overqualified on that. The second transition, I don't think Taiwan has done a very good job and needs to improve. That is the transformation of a political party, namely KMT, from a Chinese party to a Taiwanese party. For all practical purposes, KMT is a Taiwanese party, political party. The voters voted for it and it's all there. That has historical issues. You cannot do that very easily. So that's where I think the problem is right now, because once you have an election, the issue of Chinese versus Taiwanese is still there. So I think unless you have a complete transformation of a major political party that claims its main constituency on Taiwan alone, and if you're still thinking you're going back to China, you claim Mongolia and all the places as your sovereign territory, you're not going to have, you're going to be in big trouble. So that's, and domestically, you're not going to be unified. That's what I think the Thai presidency is facing. If domestically you're not unified and you have a bunch of people who lose the election and then went over to Beijing, and then you're not going to have a very strong foundation as a nation. So that's why I think, you know, that transition needs to work out. And it in that concept, in that context, I think Taiwan could play a very, very important role. Now, I was in Taiwan one time, and I look at the weather forecast, and people, and friends of me from Taiwan say, look at how pathetic we are. We talk about the weather over there. We talk about the major weather back, you know, from mainland China. Mainland China is gigantic over there, and we're so tiny country. We're affected by Taiwan, and we're so, by mainland, we're so overwhelmed. Now, listen, small country facing adversity always end up winning in many, many instances. If you look at the unification of Italy, right? This tiny country of Piedmont and Sardinia, led by this very smart king, and he unified entire Italy by playing big power politics in the 1850s, 1860s. Bismarck, the same thing, right? Now, Serbia didn't do very well because they ended up in World War I, but the idea is that there are, if you don't think of yourself as a pathetic little island besieged by a big, no, I had to use the word panda, aggressive adversary, if you think bigger, if you think about your advantage, and you think about the fundamental impact of what you represent, and you probably have a better chance to win in the end. So that's why Taiwan having more self-confidence, I think that's a very, very important, play a big time part of this.
Thanks, Rob. Since you sort of brought in the sort of the challenges, and in the interest of time, I'm going to combine the questions that I had, which is and have the other speakers sort of touch on both the sort of the role that Taiwan can play, but also the challenges that it faces in the role that it can play in the free and open Indo-Pacific. Patrick, maybe.
Sure. Briefly, Russell, the role of Taiwan in the free and open Indo-Pacific strategy of the United States is to succeed and not to fail. I mean, that's very basic. The United States likes Taiwan. It likes its democracy. It likes its economy. It likes the fact that it is interested in protecting its security and working with partners to do that. If Taiwan were to be excessively coerced, to lose democracy, to lose their economy, this would be a huge setback for the United States strategy, free and open or otherwise. It would be just seen as a huge step back, a loss of U.S. influence and power in the region. So Taiwan really is on the front lines of this strategic competition, whether we want to talk about it or not. And so let's just talk about it for a minute, because I think in terms of security, facing whether gray zone challenges, economic coercion, whether it's aviation flights that are unilaterally made on the mainland, whether it's where the PLA wants to sail its aircraft carrier, or how it wants to talk about to the United States, if you send a ship to visit Taiwan, that's the end, essentially. I mean, that kind of rhetoric is not conducive to the kind of free and open Indo-Pacific that we imagine and that we want to have as an inclusive sort of region. So the United States is going to have to stay persistently engaged, just as Taiwan needs things like persistent UAVs, by the way. You know, that you need to have constant sort of vigilance and monitoring and building and partners and working to try to maintain the space that Taiwan has fought for, that its democracy thrives on, that its economy, even as it moves to the southbound approach, and I look forward to Bonnie's excellent report. I know it'll be great coming out on Friday. But, you know, it's a complicated sort of network of potential relations that are possible. Taiwan is, I think their GDP is 20% dependent on the mainland, and 40% of the trade goes to the mainland, or something, those broad numbers, or maybe in general, that's what I read, I think, last week.
Including Hong Kong and Macau, so it's not just
that. So diversifying from that, so you can preserve, the kind of democracy and the economy that that is sought on Taiwan, I think would be a very good thing. So the United States wants Taiwan to be a success story, right? And it wants to avert failure. And meanwhile, in doing that, it can help be part of the many countries and entities and people who contribute to provide a positive example of what a peaceful, inclusive, prosperous, secure region could look like in the future.
So I'll mention three things as far as Taiwan's role, and I think that I agree with what Patrick has said, and I will build on it. I think the most important thing is to protect Taiwan and its autonomy, its security. This is becoming a bigger challenge for Taiwan, the pressure that comes from the mainland on Taiwan's international space, and particularly the military threats. And you can just look at the paper on any given day. The Liaoning just sailed through the strait again. There are flights that are taking place constantly around Taiwan. The most important thing that Taiwan needs to do is to deter an attack from China. We want Xi Jinping to get up every morning and say, this is not the day that we are going to attack Taiwan. And that is an increasingly difficult task. So it requires more effective reserves. It requires an effective volunteer military. It requires better training. There's across the board asymmetrical things that Taiwan is working on, that it needs to improve on in order to ensure its defense. So preserving peace in the Taiwan Strait is Taiwan's responsibility. Not totally up to Taiwan, but Taiwan can make a difference. So it needs to deter an attack. Secondly, in the South China Sea, I think Taiwan has a role to play in upholding rule of law and potentially in providing public goods. And I won't go into detail because I know we're limited for time. And the third thing is to create economic relationships, which again takes us back to sort of the new Southbound policy discussion, that are transparent, that are based on high standards, set an example for other countries in the region. And I'll briefly tick off what I see as the challenges to Taiwan's playing this an effective role. The biggest challenges are clearly domestic. I mean, there's competing internal challenges, as they are in every democracy. There's a lack of support for increasing defense spending. I mean, this is the old choice of guns versus butter. There's lots of other things that people want to have paid for in Taiwan. And even though President Tsai has said that she will increase defense spending by 2% a year, that's a very small amount. And it is contingent on the Taiwan economy doing better, by the way. And I think there's a lack of public appreciation for the challenges that Taiwan faces militarily and a lack of support for spending the resources that might be necessary to play a bigger role in the region. And so I think there's educational work that needs to be done there. The second set of challenges relates to China. This is obvious. I mean, there's just an ever greater ability to punish countries that want to work with Taiwan. And the very threat will intimidate countries from doing things with Taiwan. And increasingly, China's blocking Taiwan from participating actively in regional affairs. So other than APEC, it's difficult for Taiwan to do that. The third set of challenges relates to the United States. And I think we still have thinking here that the United States needs to avoid doing certain things with Taiwan because it would damage ties with China. That is always tested by every administration, and we will see how this administration does. there are times where we need to consider what the impact would be on China. Of course, we also need to consider what the impact would be on Taiwan. And if taking some action with Taiwan is going to cause China to retaliate in a way that's going to be very harmful with Taiwan, whereas our cooperation with Taiwan, the benefits are very small, and we have to consider that too. And that's something that Taipei needs to really consider. And my view is that port calls are in that category. The benefits, in my view, are very small. I think the risks of the punitive actions that China would take against Taiwan are really very great. So that's something that I think Taiwan and the United States need to think through.
So I agree with my fellow panelists on the broad concepts they've laid out and some of the specifics as well. Let me just add two quickly, and then I'm interested to get to the audience questions. So I would say, you know, I think there's an opportunity for Taiwan now to institutionalize some of its relationships in ways that get away from the political dynamics where you cause real heartburn in Beijing, Washington, and Taipei on a regular basis. And the one that I think I would be focused on right now would be arms sales and institutionalizing arms sales. You know, you've got to think about the political dynamics in each country, but I think you've got Randy Shriver in a job where he can do a lot of good for Taiwan, and I think, as Bonnie said, you want to focus that good in ways that really matter, that are going to matter over time. And I think the one that could do, that would be the most beneficial for Taiwan would be to institutionalize a process where the U.S. lives up to its responsibilities under the Taiwan Relations Act in a way that is less challenging for Taiwan over time and for Washington, because it doesn't raise as much pressure from Beijing on a regular basis in opposition to arms sales. So I think that would be one area. And I realize that's a very U.S.-focused agenda item, but the second one I'll point out is a little bit broader and will be controversial. And Bonnie and others can correct me on their disagreement with me on this. But I think the second area, which I would point out, is, look, the United States needs to uphold a rules-based order. And Taiwan has an important role to play in that, right? Not only because it's a democracy, but because it upholds rules other than democracy, right? It upholds international law. And I think there is an important role for Taiwan to play in this. And one area that I think there's going to have to be some real debate over in the next few years is that if China announces straight baselines around the Spratlys, I think Taiwan is going to have a very difficult choice to make about its response to that. And I think countries in the region are going to be hoping that Taiwan is not going to go along with something that clearly is in violation of the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. And I think it would be valuable for leaders in Taipei to think about their response to that sort of Chinese move and how Taiwan can make clear that it upholds the current rules that benefit not just Taiwan but the other countries in the region, and uphold that free and open Indo-Pacific over the next few years.
Thank you very much, Zach. We have about... I'll
reserve the 15 minutes that we have allotted for Q&A. So if you can please raise your hand, state your name, as well as your affiliation, and please make your comments a question, please, not a long-winded comment. Thank you. This gentleman in the back.
I'm S.T. Shea from Tulane University. This is my first time here. I really appreciate the presentation. My question is...
National security, you say?
And this question is for the entire panel, or do you have a specific...
Yeah, I think we'll probably agree on this answer, but if anybody wants to disagree, they should feel free to do so. I believe that developing nuclear weapons would be very much against Taiwan's security. And I think one thing we should remember is that China has, in fact, laid out certain preconditions in which it would use force against Taiwan. And one of those is Taiwan developing nuclear weapons. So I don't see much value in Taiwan having nuclear weapons. And we have a historian on the panel, so Miles can probably tell us in detail about the prior efforts that Taiwan has undertaken to develop nuclear weapons. In both cases, at least two that I know of, they were shut down by the United States. So engaging in an effort to do that would be so damaging to the U.S.-Taiwan relationship. And there is no country that is more important to Taiwan than the United States. And so undertaking an effort that the United States would be against, I think would be very, very harmful to Taiwan. You know, we have to always keep each other informed, and we shouldn't be undertaking secret operations that would be damaging to the other side. So I can't think of a scenario, in my view, unless the United States walks away from its commitments to Taiwan, that Taiwan would benefit from having nuclear weapons.
Because the Chinese in the 50s threatened to use nuclear weapons, you know, they developed nuclear weapons. Taiwan entertained the idea. They actually had the program, and I think the guy who led the Taiwanese nuclear program defected and came to the United States. The CIA actually flew to Taiwan, raided their labs, and confiscated everything that they had. So it was a primary concern for the United States. Now, Taiwanese people who, there are some people who pro this idea, who I like this idea, they decided Israel. But Israel is different. Israel is not facing the big country. Israel is surrounded by all the small, not so terribly united Arab adversaries. So, and the Israelis never say, I'm a nuclear power. They have some kind of strategic ambiguity there. That's their deterrence. Now, should Taiwan have the strategic ambiguity? You know, it's dangerous. Bonnie is absolutely right. I mean, you cannot deter China in terms of nuclear. So the value of deterrence, which I assume the nuclear weapon is all about, it's a very, very limited. We will have this. We just have this NPR pretty soon, and you will see. You know, even United States will consider much of that that nuclear deterrence issue in the context of Russia. So, but I think the best scenario you can get is that you don't want to go on the path of declare nuclear arsenal, but you might have to let people know that you have the technological capability to do it. I mean, Japan, obviously, is a good example. But Japan, of course, nobody wants to say, no, I'm going to have a nuclear program. And they're very capable. So I'll end there. So I think it's a very bad idea.
Can I just very briefly add? I think one challenge for Taiwan is, you know, the nuclear capability might deter a very high-end war, but the resources that Taiwan would have to spend to get that nuclear capability would be substantial and would substantially decrease its ability to deter a low-end conflict. And that's what we've really seen China doing in the region recently. So I think that there's another risk, which is just that the resource constraints would drive China to coercive practices, which would be much more effective, which would leave Taiwan very vulnerable, particularly because the relationship with the United States would be weaker at that point.
Right, and just to pile on that, so if we're trying to deter China from starting a war over Taiwan, it's better for the United States to be just the credible power that we are, hewing to our long-term commitments, including with a modern nuclear force that will be modernized through the Nuclear Posture Review in part, in order to deter war from happening and preserving peace. But then we are still fighting in the gray zone, the coercion, the economy, the freedom, the autonomy, the democracy, and that's the harder fight. That doesn't mean Taiwan can't be working on specialized systems like cyber, for instance, where they're in the part of the gray zone. They're very strategic systems, very advanced, but nuclear systems, it's not going to be worth it. Remember, the United States is threatening to potentially prevent a war against North Korea over its nuclear weapons program. And North Korea is a long way away from the United States. Taiwan cannot escape how close it is. And just imagine if, you know, China probably really means some of the statements it's made about that. So the process of acquiring nuclear weapons, as was identified a long time ago, is one of the most precarious times you can imagine in terms of crisis and stability. Having the nuclear weapons, things become a little more stable. People are more wary. But trying to acquire them, very dangerous.
Let me just add one more thing there. From a game, sort of war game point of view, it doesn't make much sense because China has strategic depth. Taiwan does not. A 20 megaton bomb dropped on Taiwan is gone, right? So you cannot really deter China in terms of on this from a working point of view on a nuclear issue. If you look at the last 20 some years of internet chat in China, Weibo or the WeChat, the issue that generated one of the issues that generated most discussions in China was Taiwanese. There's some college kids talking about bombing China's infrastructure, particularly Three Gorges Dam, for example. So they talk about those kind of stuff, but that's not nuclear, right? That's a totally different issue. China is a big country. If you just look at a map, you'll know it.
Do you have any more questions from the audience?
Richard Coleman, retired from the Customs and Border Protection. Other than trade, what effective leverage does the United States have in the region now, especially with the demise of its peacemaking force in the State Department?
Maybe I'll just, I'll give a few thoughts. So I think, you know, one real danger here is that people think that China has so much leverage that it can sort of do whatever it wants and it always wins. And that certainly has been the story that people have told the last few years. I don't think it's true. The piece that Russell mentioned earlier that we did on gray zone coercion, we looked at 9 cases of maritime coercion. And what we found was that actually the Chinese either failed to get their objectives or sort of had a mixed outcome in 7 of the 9 cases, right? So in less than a quarter of the cases were the Chinese actually successful in these maritime disputes, which tells us China has to have real weaknesses and the U.S. has to have substantial strengths, as do countries in the region, actually. Many of those cases in which China failed were cases where other claimants pushed back very hard. Vietnam, for example, right? So I think one of the keys for dealing in the region, especially in pushing back against China, is showing China that one is serious about what they say. And I think we have a lot of capabilities to be effective there. You know, people have to remember that countries tend to ally not just for the very good reasons that Miles mentioned, but also because of underlying shared values, right? Which are sort of at the core of NATO, but have always been a challenge in Asia. But, you know, there may be questions about this administration and the extent to which it shares values with some different parts of the world, but there's not a lot of question about whether countries in Asia primarily share values with China. The answer is no, they don't, right? So yeah, the U.S. brand may be down a bit, and the Belt and Road is pretty attractive at the moment, but over the long term, I think we still have a lot of leverage. We just have to use it.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, the United States has enormous leverage, and leverage we either don't care or we don't use it. If you go to China, you go to the neighboring countries, people are just... U.S. is basically default leader. We're the country of consequence in sheer power, hard power, or soft power. So that's what I think, you know, if you go there, no matter what's your opinion about the U.S. presidency at any time, if the president goes to China, goes to Asia, particularly this one, people think that he really means what he says or what says what he means. And that's really his credibility in a very, very weird way. I mean, if you look at the way China reacted to this president, they have never done it to any other president before, right? So, and they're really scared in many ways inside. They don't know... The certain amount of unpredictability is very, very good, in other words. So U.S. is the power of enormous influence. That influence we sometimes forget, and we don't use it. That's just a shame. China is making inroads in many of them. We have so many good studies in recent years about China's influence operations. We are open. So this is the only president who stick on reciprocity. I hope he carries it through, right? So China doing a lot of stuff on this country because the open society has its vulnerabilities, and we don't demand reciprocity in return. So that's something that I think, you know, it's a very general question, so I can give you a general answer. Sorry.
All right. Question from Michael.
Mike Ponte. I'm the director of the Indo-Pacific Initiative. Thanks for the great panel. I guess I just want to underscore one point, which I've already mentioned. President Tsai-ing-wen is a great force for in trying to position Taiwan as part of the regional framework. Part of the global cooperative training framework is part of the self-bound policy. And when she talks about, for example, the recent Chinese decision on the 503 line, she talked about it not being just a threat to Taiwan, but a question of regional security. I think that's really important that she is trying to expand the way people think about Taiwan, the way Taiwan thinks about its own borders. That's very important.
I totally agree, and indeed I only mentioned it in passing, but I think that is part of the rules-based system we are trying to uphold, and that's a great illustration. And the fact that, you know, a big country wants to use unilateral arbitrary decisions and power and coercion and not understand how others in the region and the world are going to react, they're obviously not being honest, or they don't want to look at the truth here. And we need Taiwan to stand up for the truth in cases that really do affect the region. We have so many strengths in the Indo-Pacific. China's got so many challenges as it moves. The Belt and Road Initiative is a great bumper sticker, but the reality is so much bumpier than it looks. So we have to live and find a way to live with China, but we don't have to sort of be cowed by it, and we don't have to sort of throw friends under the bus here either because of the fear that somehow they're going to be able to convert their growing power into sort of hard occupational, you know, desires, ambitions. And I don't think China really wants to get there that way anyhow. China wants to find its own great restoration in more peaceful ways, I'm sure. But we're going to be there engaged with our own interests and our own friends. And this kind of rule over these aviation routes, very important for countries to be considered. It's not just whether safety would have been, you know, impinged in that particular case. It's the principle here, and the Chinese should appreciate principle. It's the principle that matters and the rule of law that matters for all countries if we're going to survive and all actors who are going to be living together.
Yeah, I just want to add one more issue, which may not be directly related to the issue of Taiwan, but it's important here. That is the rule of Russia in Asia-Pacific. China's strategic confidence is proportional to the strength of China-Russia relationship. Okay, Russia has done something pretty bad in Asia, and China learned from it. A lot of stuff Chinese is doing, or basically Russians practice for years. For example, the idea of threatening a country you don't like with a provocative flight along this airspace. Russia's been doing it with Japan for years. China learned that. But they're doing this right now to provoke not only Japan, but also Taiwan. This is all Russian tricks. I mean, they've been doing this. They're starting to circle Taiwan with their bombers. This is a Russian example, right? So another thing, for example, Russia was very keen against U.S. missile defense. So that's why, initially, the THAAD deployment in South Korea was a Russian's issue. Russia vehemently protested this. Russia said, well, no, I don't want Russia to be the prominent adversary of the United States. We're the number two. We better take on this issue. So that's why China behaves very, very exuberantly, and it's over the top. So what Russia is doing in Asia, and it's very important. The reason why I say this is because Russia has a strong interest in developing a good relationship, economic relationship in particular, with Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan. I mean, he has said certain terms, meaning with it. Russia also entered Southeast Asia. I mean, Putin hosted the largest gala last year in Sochi, the ASEAN summit with Russia. He was talking about the importance of freedom of navigation, all the things, the veiled attack on China. So this is really important. If we keep regarding Russia as the evil empire at this stage, we're in big trouble. So we have to really get along with Russia. That's my point.
Garrett,
the
last question.
Thank you, Gary. Just a quick follow-up on this very last point that Patrick made. If we want this to be part of a rules-based society, what would be the best response exactly from the international community to the 1543 in the case in Taiwan is protested? If you go to ICAO, ICAO Secretary General is from China,
has a great civil society. I mean, this is where maybe you need law schools to come together and put together, seriously, I mean, you know, and writing in public domains. I mean, lawfare to foreign affairs. I mean, there are a lot of places where I think it's possible to make the point of what is the rule of law, what do we stand for, what are the principles by which we want to govern and live side by side. And I think just because the bureaucracy of the international machinery may be run by apparatchiki or by Chinese or by, you know, whatever, doesn't mean we cannot work around that machinery to make the same larger point. After all, the Chinese have worked very well around the N-class ruling, the arbitrational panel ruling in the South China Sea. So there are a lot of different ways to skin a cat, as they say.
I guess I'd answer that a little bit differently. I think, you know, nobody on this panel is an international lawyer, but probably if you had a panel of international lawyers, you could get people to argue both sides of this issue. I'm sure a lawyer could argue that what China did is not against international law. I'm sure you could get somebody to argue that it is. But the real problem here is that when you have any country that has its airline and is making its own airlines and it unilaterally declares a new route, that there needs to be discussions with others that can be affected. I mean, let's not even say threatened, but affected by it. And that was certainly violated in this case. And I'm sure you could find in some of the ICAO charter and some of the wording language that they have that applies to airlines all over the world. And we know that Taiwan's, what is it, CAA has actually good conversations and frequent meetings with their counterparts in China. So it's not as if there isn't a mechanism to talk about this. But what the international community can do, I think, is at least call China out. This is, it's not good for regional security. It's not good for any country, I would say globally. So, you know, countries who meet with China can express to Chinese officials that they thought that this was a bad move, not helpful, not something that China should repeat. And that really Beijing should be talking to Taiwan because it affects everyone. If there's an accident on those routes, there can be any nationality, right? Can be on somebody's airplanes, whether it's China's or Taiwan's. But more public statements could be made. So yeah, sure, I think the international community can do more. But I'm not sure that the right thing to do is just to make it a rule of law issue. I mean, as I said, you could probably argue both ways. The Chinese are not going to say that that airspace belongs to Taiwan and doesn't belong to them. So that's a non-starter.
You said it's international airspace.
International.
Yeah. It actually moves like 60 miles west of the median line. The actual flight.
No, it's closer to the median line. Right, 8 miles from it. Right. So that would just be my suggestion.
And so with that, please join me in thanking our panelists. Thank you for our next event.